Today is July 31st, 2015. My name is Christina Varro McElhaney, interviewing for Dinner 2040 Oral History Project. I am interviewing Mr. Jason Matthews at ASU Core Building on ASU Tempe campus. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm just going to move that a bit.
Great.
So can you tell me a little bit about your where and you were born?
Sure. I was born in Reno, Nevada, and then moved to Tucson when I was one. And so I can't say I'm a native to Arizona, and people will tell you if they're a neighbor native to Arizona. So I'm in the other 70% that's not non-native of Arizona, but I have to say I've been an Arizona resident for at least 37 years. So
tell me a little bit about your parents and the importance. Maybe did they kind of expose you to I know you've worked a lot in nonprofits mm-hmm. and things like that. And tell me a little bit about your family.
Absolutely. And it's something I'm very comfortable talking about. My mom was 17 when she had me, and I never met my father. I didn't have any siblings. And so she raised me by herself. And the experience of living in poverty, being the recipient of government programs, public assistance, food stamps at the time, the benefits of even receiving food at a food bank, getting help from others, has really framed why I'm here today. Not only in the, it's been a contributing factor in my drive and ambition, as my mom never graduated from high school. She certainly didn't go on to college. And it's to me, I'm always trying to help others and other families, other parents, other individuals that have gone through what I had gone through and hopefully can achieve the kind of success that I have and even more that they can possibly do. And if I can be a part of that, that's great. And when my mom passed away when I was 21, and actually when she was 38, and which is always a strange when, you know, my next birthday, I'll be actually living longer than she was, reflecting upon even in that time, which really kind of really solidified this role of how can I work to help repair the world. And I actually, came in later in life, someone who is, you know, embraces my Jewish heritage. And there's this concept of, Tikkun Olam, which is repair the world. And how can I do my part to help repair the world for other individuals? And, it's my honor and pleasure, and it keeps me happy and keeps me motivated, and it's something that is just a great, it's my North Star that keeps me going.
Do you share the story with others that are going through the struggle right now, and are they, what is their reaction?
I do, and I feel that especially as it relates to human services and relates to food insecurity and hunger and poverty, and a lot of these kind of services, it's very important to share these stories, to help individuals see that they're not the only ones going through it. There's so many aspects that, these are embarrassing, sometimes shameful, hurtful, hard aspects of life. And it's not easy for someone to open up about this. I run parallels, you know, and through my own history where I have, I've gone through a divorce, and gosh, if you, you know, as soon as you mention you go to a divorce and have realized, oh my gosh, there's so many other people have divorce stories. And it's just, I think that, and that's just one small example, but to me, sharing this story and to try to humanize it and to see that it's not the other, it's not some, you know, poverty or hunger or homelessness. It's not some other person that lives some other place We can visit and then come back, that it is a part of us. And also make it real and tangible as opposed to something that can be manipulated into a myth or a legend. Unfortunately, in my personal opinion, you'll have a lot of these stories that turn into, well, that's the raise yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's the that drive and ambition and that, you know, that's, you know, good, you know, kind of, I don't know, again, those kind of big mythical kind of things. That to me is, it's a fallacy. Yeah, there was a lot of myself that helped in these kinds of aspects, but really when telling the story and sharing this, and not only to humanize it, but also to humanize how I got there and how people can help with it. If it was not for the rest of the community that helped me and helped my mother, I wouldn't be here. It's not, I can't just say that, yeah, as a strapping young 7-year-old, I could have totally done all those things, you know, or as a crafty 10-year-old, I could have done blank. Or even as a really scrappy 15-year-old, I mean, there has been so many other markers throughout my life, which included my, you know, my mother and some of that stuff, and sometimes it didn't, but it was also the other families that kind of adopted me, you know, on the block, you know, and made sure that, you know, I had a safe place to go when my mother was working nights at a bar. That it was, you know, teachers and coaches that, made sure I did my homework and made sure that, yelled at me when I needed to be yelled at and kind of re-guided me and recalibrated me. And I share this story because it's not just to humanize the aspect of poverty, but it's also to see how the community in Tucson, the community that was around me, by people just giving just a little bit of time and a little bit of attention to someone that is in need, they were able to make a tremendous difference. And it wasn't just one person. It wasn't just 5 people. It was this community time and time and time again that reinforced it, that helped me get to this point today. And now my obligation and in my honor now is to be a part of that community that helps others. And so by sharing that story, it's not just to get the, oh, so sad. It's more or to get sympathy. It's really, and not only just to humanize it, but then to try to channel that into, even if you did one thing, and even if you do that one thing over again, that could be something that can make a big difference.
Is it hard to get that message across sometimes to the community that doing that one thing would make such a, like almost a domino effect? I mean, yeah. People probably think no, or don't even realize that it's in their own backyard.
It's very difficult. There's that old story of the guy who's walking on the beach and picking up the starfish and throwing it into the ocean. And the nice, friendly, kind of optimistic story, aspect is like, well, you know, how can you save all the animals in the ocean? And what difference does it mean to you? And the guy picks up the starfish, looks at it and says, well, I'm making a difference to this starfish. And he throws it back in the ocean. Well, the cynical view is like, well, you know, does that starfish even care what you did? You know, I mean, are you, by picking up the starfish, are you giving your germs to it and actually killing the starfish? I mean, you don't even know, maybe that starfish is already dead. I mean, all these different things. And I think that it's, to your question, it is, you see that a lot, especially when it comes to, say, voting behavior and even in impact of charitable giving. Why should I give blank or give blank attention when that will never be a part of the bigger change? And you'll see, to me, kind of the reaction to that is the shift from transformational change, big change, to smaller transactional incremental change. Not even incremental, just transactional, to where it's easier to build someone a house through Habitat for Humanity, and not picking on Habitat for Humanity. They're a great organization. They do great things. But it's easier to build someone a house in a Saturday afternoon than to spend time with that family and to deal with the root causes of why they need the house in the first place. And I think people know that. I think people know that these are big, hard issues. And to me, it comes down to it's seeing your role in your place, your moment, your opportunity within a community, and that turning outward and understanding that no matter where you are, you have benefited from things that are completely out of your control that you may not even know about. And you are also a contributing factor to other people's benefits, whether you know about it or not. And it's just that sense of awareness. And by having people to take the time, and it's not just like one amazing conversation. It's typically a series of conversations, and to demonstrate that change, that's the transformation. The challenge is that the issues that we're dealing with get to be so big. Ending hunger, ending poverty, you don't know where to start. I've had too many of, you know, again, coaches and teachers, you know, have told me like, well, gosh, this project's too big. Where do you start? And it's like, well, you know how to eat an elephant, you know, one bite at a time, you know, it's demonstrating with, even as you take a journey, and also understand that sometimes that the outcome is not going to be, sometimes the outcome is the journey. It's not the actual destination, and that it's the practice that, you know, even when in the talk of ending hunger or in my colleagues in ending homelessness, for as long as there will be human beings, there will still be hunger and homelessness. But through the journey and developing a better system and a better practice of how we interact with those human beings that are facing hunger and homelessness, that gets us to where we need to be. That is the real goal. But to just say like, you know, I am the director of starting a long-term journey in order to increase food insecurity over generations is not only will not fit on a business card, but you're going to lose people immediately. And it doesn't include that sense of call to action that inspires people, or at least it garners enough bandwidth and attention to get them to pause for 3 seconds in order to say, oh yeah, hunger's bad. Got it. And we should end that. It's the next question. It's the how. That's the hard thing. And so it's been my honor and privilege to have conversations like that with everyone I can find, but just showing how their little actions have a compounding effect. And what I don't think people see, and I've only seen in doing this for a while, is that the compounding effect is the compound effect in you, not the compound effect in the people you're working with. It is when you build a culture of philanthropy, it's a culture within yourself. It's not, and then that's something that you then teach within your family, within your friends, within your children. And that culture of philanthropy is something that you, as you do this over time, as a practice, that is when you will see that kind of transformative change. It's not a new concept. It is something that that institutions of faith have been doing for a very long time. It is what, well, really ingenious brand management have been doing. You know, there's some people who just love Apple products, and they love them. You know, why do they love them? Why? And it's the same thing that an Apple iPhone is the same as a Samsung Galaxy phone. They do practically the same things. But they have changed, they've built a culture of devotion that brand has become part of their own personal identity.
Very true.
Yeah.
But now how do you get that kind of, let's talk about that culture of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. How do you develop that within the community itself? I mean, you said it's within oneself. How does that process start?
Deliberate and intense repetitive engagement, and also understanding where, not only where your audience is at, but understand the constraints in which they're facing. I have the privilege and the luxury to spend and to get paid to talk about these issues. To study these issues, to affect change within this area. I am a fraction of a minority that gets to do that. And understanding where people are, how these issues may or may not impact them, understanding not just the culture of where they are, but, and it's not just culture and race and ethnicity and gender and sexuality, but it's the culture of time and space. And that is something that, by understanding that, it allows you to have those deliberate conversations. And so you meet people where they are, and then we have conversations. You can't go into someone and say, especially a working poor family, if someone were to come to my mother when she was raising, you know, a little bratty little boy, probably at the time, and wanted to stop and say, look, you know, Jamie, gosh, I know you're just on your way to go work nights, and I know you're just leaving your son here, and he's 8 years old, and we're leaving him alone because there's no childcare. But do you have 15 minutes to talk about food insecurity? No. She's going to say, I got to get to work. And don't talk to my kid, you know? And so it's creating that space. It's undertaking the time to understand and to build a relationship. And it doesn't have to be that long. And even the word relationship is something that needs to be redefined, because it's a great word, but I think it turns into like, well, you know, we don't have a time to build a relationship, you know. But even understanding that even in small conversations, you can develop a tie and a seriousness and a deliberateness that connects people in time. That building a culture of philanthropy starts with those incremental, deliberate building those connections and time. And then doing that with individuals, someone who has passion on the issue, and it doesn't have to be knowledge, it doesn't have to be an expertise, it's just interest and passion. And then getting them to connect with someone else. To me, that is the true form of advocacy. But it starts with a conversation. The trick is then to channel, once you spark the energy and that fire, it's then channeling that into action. That reinforces the conversation, and then the physical action further reinforces the conversation. And then you switch from, you give them the opportunity to then be that change agent. not just through actions, but then for them to share that story. That is how social academics start, to borrow Gladwell's term, that tipping point kind of work. And it doesn't, like, one person, there are very few people that can stand on a stage and rally tens of thousands of people and get them to do blank. And to get them to do blank well. but by starting small and reaching people where they are in individual conversations, that is how you mobilize people to mobilize a community. And that is how you build a culture of philanthropy. That's how you build a culture of anything, really. But using the targeted focus of philanthropy, if that's the right verb, basically, using kind of switching the word around, that is where you can demonstrate that. There's a lot of proven methods that have shown that over time. The challenge is that it is not only hard, it's slow. And things that are hard and things that are slow in the modern day age they're just less appealing. They want easy and fast. There's been ways to kind of manipulate that a little bit on, you know, the hooks, you know. How can we get you to come and pay attention to us? You know, and there's marketing ideas, there's advertising ideas, there's, to use our Habitat for Humanity example, they would argue that by getting them to build a house, that is the hook that gets them connected with the issue. It kind of just depends on what they do next after that. But
so let's go back a little bit and let's talk about the role of education in your life and mm-hmm. the impact that it had.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you went to school mm-hmm. or any teachers or mentors that you mentioned them that were instrumental?
Absolutely. Being raised in Tucson, I was very fortunate to have amazing teachers in my life, especially in public school. Proud Ranger from Rincon High in Tucson, and had incredible teachers. Christine Wald Hopkins is one of them that was absolutely dynamic and pushing me and challenging me out of complacency. You know, she was the one who, she was an English teacher, which my further degrees were, one is in English literature, probably no coincidence, but she was the one when I went to go see the school counselor in high school during that time, I think it was junior year or whatever. And they said, well, you know, the school counselor said, well, guess what? You know, looking at, you know, what your grades are and where you are, you know, gosh, this is, you should probably, you know, just go down this particular path and start in a community college and go down this path. It'd probably be the smart thing to do. And I went back and reported that to her. And she just said, no, that's not for you. No. I'm going to give you someone else to talk to. And she was the one who said, you need to dream bigger. You need to be more aspirational. You could do this. You just need to, you know, she believed in that aspect. And that was just, especially for education, that was game changing. I've also been very fortunate to have a lot of great coaches. I have no athletic ability whatsoever, but it is a lot of great coaches that allowed me to try hard. I always like to joke that Rincon High's football team was so bad that anyone could try, and which was really great for me because that allowed me the opportunity to probably, and just kind of working this out for the first time, it allowed me to work out a lot of my challenges at home on the field. And And whether or not we won the game, it was the journey. And that allowed me, and the trust in that, especially, and just, you know, and even to this day, I may not know everything. I certainly don't have the athletic ability again. But my goal is to outwork you. And if I can just put in that time and that drive, that's going to help me get to where I need to be. And because of that, that really helped in trying to identify a lot of leadership positions, whether it was captain of teams or kind of shepherding into like student council clubs or those kinds of things, and which was very helpful and definitely very formative. And especially because at that time, with my mother working nights a lot and working weekends, because she worked in as a bartender waitress for most of that time during high school, I just wasn't around. I mean, I was just at home by myself. And so if I needed a place to be, just because I didn't have, there was just myself at home. And so that really helped a lot. And there's, I knew we got to a point to where I was getting to a point to where my mother couldn't support me and couldn't really understand what I was doing. And that led to some really hard, hard things. It was Christine Wald Hopkins who actually encouraged me to shoot big and apply to a school not in state. And I applied to and actually got into Occidental College. And that was a huge achievement. And it was actually her alma mater. I'm sure that she had a great letter that helped with that. but it was also facing up against that, the reality of poverty, which the tuition was so astronomically high that I couldn't afford to go. And not even having the debt resources to do that. And that kind of tug and pull, and that was hard. But I was fortunate enough to, go to the U of A, which is almost like the fifth year of high school for a lot of people, first year schools. And I was very fortunate to finally over time find that kind of connection within political science, and English literature, to really help me, just find that passion and channel that passion into something tangible. For me, political science, reading has always been something that I've always enjoyed to do, still enjoy doing. Storytelling is something that I've always embraced. I probably wouldn't be able to describe it then, I certainly do now. And so the English literature part was very easy. On the political science side, I was very fortunate to get a scholarship and has some support from family members, like a great grandmother that I barely knew. And I was able to go to a program called Close Up my senior year in high school, which was a 4-day intensive in Washington, D.C. And I knew right then that I wanted to work in public service. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know. I think I said I want to work in politics. I don't even know what that meant at the time. But that experience was able to broaden change my entire perspective on the world, and to see how, I remember very distinctly standing at, there was on the Capitol, there's a veranda that looks out onto the mall. And I remember standing there thinking about all the things that have happened there, the things that I just didn't even really appreciate, and thinking to myself that this is a place of change, and that this is profound for a 17-year-old. I have no idea where this came from, but that I had ownership in this, but I also had responsibility to this, and literally, and like my hands were on the granite, and just thinking to myself like, wow, I own and I'm responsible for this. And so many people have been before me, and so many people will be here after me. And so what can I do? And that really informed that political science background and that emphasis. And I'm still a political geek. I love election seasons. That's my sporting season. I can really go full nerd on that whole thing, so I just won't. But it's been interesting because the political science and helped me start to understand the behaviors of collective groups, which has been a wonderful foundation for work in human services and studies in poverty. It is, we tend to think of elections of all about being one candidate. No, it's the collective decision of a bunch of people. And how a campaign, not a candidate, but a campaign of time and of marketing and of energy influences that collective action, and both in negative and positive senses. And that has been, I've always looked at that lens in the work in trying to help people in poverty, because it's funny how, you know, people ask, like, why are people poor? Why, what, if you could do one thing, what would you do? If you have all the resources in the world, what would you do? And it's like, well, it gets complicated, you know, because really you need like a, I would build a time machine, you know, and change the entire, you know, the world back to another one big moment, you know, or, you know, or I would, you know, completely move an entire population from one community to another community. And it gets hard quick. So those things led me to graduate from the U of A, moved up to the big city, Phoenix, to get a job because there's less opportunity up there. I actually ended up going to ASU and got my master's in public administration, which was tremendous. What was great about this program here, I will definitely say this, and for the record, make sure to pay your alumni dues. Got me involved in the Alumni Association. But the practitioners at the ASU College of Public Programs and in the Master's of Public Administration program, they were just not only just instrumental, but just so exciting. They were rock stars. And they were able to demonstrate change, not just the theoretical, but to actually, it's nice to read this book, but let's go try it with real people. You know, it's one thing to be able to say, you know, like, we're going to talk about how to mobilize people and, you know, the public HR systems and all these different things. And it's like, that's great. So now this is how we actually worked with this union to get this done. And these were the positive things that we were able to do. And here's some of the challenges that we were actually able to do. And that has been fantastic. Through that internship, through that program, I got a management internship with the city of Tempe. My emphasis was on city county management, and just the how this industry works and how the relationship it has with its constituents and its taxpayers. And that's been absolutely amazing. So
I'm going to go back just a little bit about when you were at U of A. Mm-hmm. Were you a first-generation college student?
Yeah, with my mom, yeah. Okay. Later on, I found out that I had other family members that had gone mm-hmm. To college when my mom passed away. So when I started college, I didn't actually know. Very, very small family, and a lot of kind of a military brat family where people are all over the place. And when my mom passed away, it was my fourth year in school when she passed away in April of that year. So right when I was just about to look like graduating with a poli-sci degree. And so I freaked out and, I actually turned my minor into another major and stayed an extra year. It was good for everybody, especially for me. But in that, an uncle that didn't know really existed anymore, resurfaced, and he was in the military, and he was a doctor. Wonderful, funny story how his son Thane literally went to the same high school as I did, and when the August after I graduated in May started, and everyone said, "Do you have this brother?" And no, and just didn't know each other. So, yeah.
What were some of the challenges? Is that since you were starting college and it's the news.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no one to really go talk to about the issues or problems that you may encounter mm-hmm. as a first generation college student. You know, what did you do and how did you tackle those?
The biggest challenge is having to work full time and go to school. And so I've been working since 15 and a half. I was pretty much working almost full time, even my last couple of years in high school, to help support the family. That just was compounded going to school because now you have more expenses. And while I was very, very fortunate, and I remember at the U of A, there was a financial aid professional. I remember going to her office to fill out your FAFSA forms and all these different things. And she's like, "This is the first time in your life you're going to be grateful you're poor." And I kind of looked at it, and like part of me was like, "Hey, I'm not poor." And like, yeah, I'm like really poor. And like, but it... she was able to really keep my student loan debt down tremendously for my undergraduate, which I'm very thankful for. But even with the aid that I was able to receive, it still wasn't enough to support myself. I've been working, you know, absolutely full time since then. So that constraint of time, and this is kind of goes into, you know, people always ask, you know, what is the disadvantage of being poor, and I say it's not really income, but it's time. There's a lot of people that are out there that live in self-sufficient communities that don't really need a lot of income, but when you do need a lot of income, you need to spend that time to earn that income. And if there's not really good jobs to do that, then you need the time to do so. So for me, the biggest constraint of being a first year is not only not having the income or a support system, the financial support system to help with that, but it also wasn't I mean, we talk a little bit also in our work in hunger and poverty is that the support system that teaches you resiliency. And I was fortunate to get into a bridge program for poor students and minority students, a summer bridge program, which was nice. And I know there's versions of it. And I think they do an okay job of just making sure that you have a place to touch base with. But what was the big irony, and I didn't know this at the time, is that the solution was come to these meetings, spend more time that you don't have with us to come do counseling, to come do group meetings. We'd really like you, I mean, because that's, you need that support system. And I'm like, that's great. I got to go to work now. And since I don't have a car, because I can't afford a car, it takes me 45 minutes to ride there on a bicycle. So that extra, you know, gap of time, I'll come to the meetings when I have time. And I'm sure that it makes sense, but it's not being a first generation. It's not having someone that says something to the point of like, don't take that job. Okay. And it was the job I had in high school. And I was, you know, for me at that particular juncture in my life, I worked long and hard enough to get to a, you know, assistant manager to where I was earning more money. So I was thinking about more money. And so it was worth the, you know, the 2 hour long commute, you know, on both sides in order to do that. And if someone were to then say, you know, Jason, they're not really paying you that much. And what if, you know, your time is actually valuable? What if you were to try to find a job on campus that doesn't actually pay as much, but it's not going to, it's only going to be like the difference of like $3, but you can literally walk there from class, you know? And that would have been that kind of guidance that you just don't have. You don't have someone who's gone through that journey. And so I think that, and having conversations with other people that have done like similar bridge programs and people that are trying to work in that field, I'm like, you need people that have actually gone down that journey to then help with the people that are starting that journey. It's the old story of, you know, one person falls down into a hole and doesn't know how to get out, so the person jumps down there with them because they've been gone there and there before. They know the way out. You need someone that knows the journey and can literally say, like, I know income's a big deal, huge deal. Oh my gosh, that's probably the only thing you're thinking about because you're thinking about paying your bills. Let's get you income, but let's try to do it in a way where you can do both. At least you can study easier. So that was hard. I mean, my grades suffered for it. I certainly wasn't the best student. I probably had a, you know, I'd be generous to say a high C average in my undergraduate as overall. And it's, you know, my basic, my core curriculum classes, the requirements that you need to do, versus my major. My major, I gave time to that. I wanted to, you know, my stuff that I had to take, I'd squeeze that in, you know, and that's hard.
So let's talk about how you became involved in your current organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So I work at the Valley Sun United Way. I am their director of Ending Hunger. I've been there since last September. And but I've been working in human services and anti-poverty work going on 13 years. From the start of from my master's degree and that connection with the management internship position at the City of Tempe, my first real job after that internship ended was with a nonprofit called Tempe Community Council, which serves as their the city's nonprofit, basically, a nonprofit arm. And they really started the work into not only community building, but also work in homelessness and anti-poverty work and those kinds of things. I was there for 8.5 years, rose to assistant director, chief program officer, looked for another opportunity to kind of broaden my scope, was able to go over to United Food Bank, which is a regional food bank that covers all the East Valley to New Mexico, as their chief development officer in charge of fundraising and marketing a bunch of other things. And then that really solidified that work in hunger and working in especially food insecurity. And that I got some fun stories from the food bank. But that was able to, that underscored that importance of food insecurity and hunger. And to me, I'm way biased. And what I'm allowed to work on at the Valley Sun United Way, which is to really coordinate both on a strategic level and a kind of more of a tactical level, the Ending Hunger Plan for Maricopa County, and how we play a part in coordinating that plan through convening of people, rallying support, raising money, allocating money, starting, trying programs, testing issues, taking things to scale, the things that work, and then repeat and until we can achieve our current goal. We have a 2020 goal of trying to reduce chronic food insecurity in Maricopa County by 2/3. That's 2/3 of 82,000 families or households. I'm sorry.
So I'm going to just kind of touch on the, you mentioned food bank stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you share some of those food bank stories?
I have lots of food bank stories. Yeah, I would love to. So I think food banks are fantastic. I think that it's, and United Food Bank, where I had the honor of working with and under the mentor of Bob Evans, who he came to me and he said, like, I only have a year left, but I would love to work with you. And here's an opportunity, and I want, you'd be great for our organization, and maybe you can get something out of it too. So, in that, we were actually able to, as a chief development officer, being in charge of raising revenue and telling and the communications of that organization. It was the opportunity and to really work with individuals that are at the very beginning of the journey towards abject poverty. there's something about, because the issue of hunger is very, very difficult in the United States and Arizona to really grapple with, because the definition is wrong. We talk about even hunger, and very few people talk about food insecurity. Food insecurity is even seen as a wonky kind of term that I have used. I've told that story so many different times of, this is what food insecurity is. And it's wonky. They're like, food what? Like, what do you mean the food is when you say it's insecure, like is it bad for you? Like, it just confuses people. So then people will default to, oh, hungry people. And so, because it's easier for people to get to. So at the food bank, in trying to generate resources and generate volunteers for this particular issue, you quickly realize that not only is it a hard issue for people to talk about and to understand, but even the people that are seeking the services, they don't want to talk about it. They want to get in, they want to get out. And because there's so much shame and guilt and stigma that goes not just with poverty, but with food, to look yourself in the mirror every morning and say, I can't feed myself well, not feed yourself, period, feed yourself well, nor my kids, is an embarrassing, horrible admission. And to move beyond that, to ask for help, is an incredible act of courage and bravery. Some of the most bravest individuals I've ever seen are those that have crossed the threshold of a food bank, because they have, in most cases, things have gotten so bad that they have to. It's a point of desperation. But the opportunity at a food bank to work with those individuals and to gain their trust is that there's an opportunity there to then help them in a way that can be transformative, that could prevent them from becoming a chronic homeless individual, can prevent them from making horrible decisions on crime, prostitution, abandoning their children, these kinds of issues. Food insecure, hungry people are desperate. desperate people make irrational choices. And that's where things get bad quick. And it's really easy. If you're hungry, if you haven't eaten well, you're not thinking clearly. In the Jewish tradition, we fast for 26 hours on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. About hour 18 into that fast, I'm thinking less about what's being said in the services and more about what I'm going to put in my stomach, 8 hours from that point. You're not focused. You're not thinking clearly. It even has the opportunity of making physical changes to your body, to where it could almost debilitate you. And that's just by not eating well, let alone starving. So in those stories, not only does it help you really understand what does hunger look like in Arizona? What does it look like in the United States? And it helps you see the shift, and this is part of the storytelling, is hunger in America is less about starvation, it's more about malnutrition. And that's very difficult for people to understand. And it's also very difficult for people to react to. It's easier to react to someone who's starving. It's harder to react to someone who's facing malnutrition. If they're starving, you give them food. It doesn't matter what that food is. It could be a Twinkie. It could be a cheeseburger. It doesn't matter. And a structural challenge is within food banks. And it's not, there's some incredible work that's been done, and it's going to seem like a criticism of food banks, and it's not a criticism. They play a very important role on the emergency response. But the need within the emergency response food system is so vast. In Arizona, this is the statistical part of the interview, 1 in 4 children are food insecure. And that's growing to 1 in 3. It's like 29%. 1 in 5 adults. It's 20%. 1 in 7 seniors in Arizona that are food insecure. In the last Feeding America, Hunger in America study from 2014, so last summer, that's about 1.1 million people in Arizona that face food insecurity at some time. We only have 6.5 million people in this state. That's a high estimate. That's a lot of people that are facing this issue. And since food insecure people don't look like poor people, they don't have, when I say that, it's, I borrow some term from colleagues in homelessness. It's like, the great thing about homelessness is that it's easy for people to get their heads around. They can understand it because they could see it. They may stereotype it. They may think, man with a beard, shopping cart, got it, homeless, see it. Got it. Okay. Even though that's only 15 to 20% of total homeless population. Mostly it's individuals that are working and families and children and those kinds of things. But it's easy for you to get around that. When you go to hunger, they think, oh, sub-Saharan Africa, flies all over their eyes, bloated stomach. Gotcha. That's what hunger is in America. You're like, no, it's not. It's actually someone who's probably going to be obese. Someone who is going to have chronic health issues. 60% of that 1.1 million people in Arizona work 32 hours plus a week. It's people like you and me. They're doing everything that they're supposed to, but it's not enough. It's a poverty issue, and specifically working poor issue. It's not zero income. It's mostly they have not. It's not enough income. So that's one big theme, one big story that really, really drives home at a food bank. A second big story, and this is my language, is that I never really understood this issue until working at a food bank, is that we as a society have a very bad relationship with food. And that bad relationship with food is just at its utmost visibility. It's glowing with visibility at a food bank. In how people, what they eat, the food choices they make, the food that's thrown away, the choice dilemma with food, cooking. There's so many other, it's just a bad, bad relationship with food. How that you see that is people will choose easy, convenient, even in desperation. Easy, convenient, because that is what we as a society in the marketplace demands more, sometimes it becomes the only option. Easy, convenient, over time, builds a codependency to, well, lack of resiliency skills. I see more people, and you can talk to a lot of different food banks. It's one of these weird kind of like stories that kind of pops up in the food banking world. Easy Mac, which is like a brand of you know, mac and cheese that you can microwave, one of the highest demand items. Rice and beans is harder because not everyone knows how to cook rice and beans. And they'll prefer something that can be microwaved over something that you have to cook. Fresh fruits and vegetables, not just only, like, I used to think it was like that was a luxury item. Still is. It's also not preferred. There's people who don't know how to grow, not just grow, but they don't know how to prepare and cook these fresh fruits and vegetables. And sometimes brains already go into like, oh yeah, you know, like kale and Swiss chard and all those different things. Like, what are you going to do with that? It's like, no. We're talking tomatoes. We're talking iceberg lettuce. We're talking potatoes. We're talking these kinds of staple traditional things. They just don't know how to cook it. So they won't pick it, you know. I'd much rather have instant mashed potatoes than a 5-pound bag of potatoes. Those two big stories at a food bank have what, and seeing the opportunity of affecting that change at the Valley Sun United Way, that was the big opportunity for me. Because what food banks do really incredibly well is that they're excellent at ending hunger today. Tomorrow, we don't know. So as long as you can provide a system for people to come back to the food bank, it used to be it was episodic hunger. It's now changing to supplemental food. That's a different conversation. The food bank tradition was born in Phoenix, born in St. Mary's, a food bank connected with the Catholic diocese. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And they do incredible, amazing things. But even in that tradition, the food bank was always seen as kind of that food pantry that, you know, the pastor would have for emergency situations. When it shifts from that one-time emergency to, yep, you're going to keep coming back, it's a different conversation. So what the advice on the United Way is looking at is when you work with chronic food insecurity, the definition of chronic food insecurity from the U.S. Department of Agriculture is individuals that are that seek and receive an emergency food source 3 out of 4 weeks in a month and or 7 out of 12 months in a year. They're the frequent flyers. Data is very hard in food and food systems just because it's still new and because food insecurity and hunger relief really started in the faith tradition, which there's a wonderful, beautiful things about that. But the downside is that when you have a bunch of volunteers running a food pantry, they're less concerned about data collection and more concerned about feeding the immediate line of people in front of them as it helps them demonstrate their faith. And the beauty in that is that it's judgment-free and its immigration status or any of these other things like that just disappear, which is fantastic. The downside is that telling the story with data is less of an issue and less of a demand. That's starting to change. Slow. So chronic, to give an idea, the estimate with Maricopa County is that of that 1.1 million people in Arizona, there is about 620,000 individuals that are facing some type of chronic food insecurity. I'm sorry, just regular food insecurity. Of the chronic food insecurity, we estimate that close to half of those individuals are chronic food insecure. So when we look at 82,000 households within Maricopa County, and a household can be a household of one or a household of 10, because that's what the data tells us, we estimate that that could be upwards of around 200,000 to 300,000 individuals within Maricopa County that are chronic food insecure. So when we look at chronic food insecure, that's when we're looking at people that, again, that's the combination of people who have zero income and people who have, they're working full time. That's a different story and a different conversation.
So I'm going to back up just a little bit. You mentioned the definition of food insecurity. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Absolutely. So food insecurity is not starvation. Food insecurity is not knowing where your next meal is coming from. If you are food secure, you know that you are going to eat and you know where your meal is going to come from. You have that sense of security. So not only is food insecure having the lack of that, but what it creates is stress and anxiety. So again, food insecure individuals are not starving. They are just intermittently eating without any kind of knowledge of when that's going to happen. So when they do eat, they will overeat. They will hoard food. They will just make really odd choices around food because it's a scarce resource. And so when they do have the opportunity to eat, they will try to pack as many calories as they possibly can and then take it with them and hoard. The best demonstration of this, and almost like a key indicator, and my wife works as a preschool teacher. Really easy to tell food insecure kids because they're the ones who don't eat all their snacks and they put the leftover snacks in their pocket. It's stress and anxiety. They're saving it for later. Happy food insecure kids eat all their snacks because they know they're going to get some more snacks. It's just that little example is what happens with all food insecure individuals in some way, shape, or form. So that would be the definition of that. And then chronic is just obviously that over time.
So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned the importance of data and that mm-hmm. it's not being collected. Mm-hmm. Why is it I understand why it's not being collected, but why is it important to help for people to understand the food issue, the food insecurity issues?
There's this old expression, I think, from Mike Bloomberg, you know, believe in God, everything else, use data. It's probably a bad expression, but the data tells a story. It proves the story. Granted, you know, and I learned this in politics, data can be used against you, and doesn't matter, you know, whatever you come up with for data, someone else will come up with data that counters your argument. But without data, then it's just hearsay and guesswork. And so data is so critical in order to tell an accurate, reliable, dependable story of what you're trying to make an argument for. Why it's so critical with food insecurity and hunger is that you're working in and within an issue that many people will argue does not exist in the United States. And this is where data can be used against you. Example of poverty and obesity are linked. That freaks people out because it doesn't make any sense. How can you have someone that is starving to be overweight? That doesn't make any sense, right? But if you think that food insecurity is starvation, yep, that's how it makes sense. Like you should be like with flies all over your eyes and a bloated stomach. You should be completely and totally decimated. That's what starvation is. That's what hunger is. But if you switch from food insecurity as malnutrition, and you say like, well, actually, you know, someone who's, you know, food insecure, they have scarce resources, and in scarce resources, they're going to be as efficient with the dollar per calorie as they can. One of the best examples of the most efficient caloric to dollar examples out there is the quarter pounder with cheese. It's amazing. It's like, what, 1,500 to 1,800, 2,000 calories for under $2. From a pure, like, scientific fact, that's incredible. That's amazing. Oh, my gosh. I mean, just, that's great. But if that's your primary food source that you're always going to, and a related, like, antidote. I heard on one podcast a family practitioner who was working in Washington, D.C., and she had this one saying that has always stuck with me. Why do poor people eat poorly? The answer, because it tastes good. And related back to my own story, when you're poor, not only is time a luxury, but normalcy is a luxury. And there is nothing that makes you more normal than going through a drive-thru or ordering a pizza, just like everyone else who's tired on a Friday night. That's what people do. I see that lady with, you know, that Suburban full of cars taking their kids to go get a Happy Meal. Why can't I take my kids to it? Oh, and that's cheaper than cooking? And it takes less time to cook? I'm going to do that. That's hard. Because that story is very difficult, it's hard to tell data on that. So the data is so critical in order to tell that story. The challenge is that once you shift, it's easy to get support for starvation. That's actually really easy to get started. I mean, no elected official want the image of, you know, emaciated, you know, people wandering the streets like some zombie apocalypse movie, okay? They will be all over that in a second, okay? But once you shift it to malnutrition, then it gets hard, because now you're dealing with, like, people get really concerned about choices. I've heard this time and time again. You know, those people, it's always those people, especially those people who receive SNAP benefits or food stamps, with that extra money that they get, with all that extra money, which for an individual is maybe an extra $100 a month, you know, all that extra flush with cash money that they have, I'm being sarcastic, is if they just were making smarter choices and just weren't buying all that, you know, all those chips and soda and everything like that, you know, they wouldn't be so fat. They wouldn't get, you know, those chronic health diseases of, you know, the top three using data happen to be diabetes, hypertension, and osteoporosis. Those are the top three. They're just making bad choices. They just don't know enough. They're just choosing this path, this lifestyle. I love these arguments. I actually get almost probably inappropriately excited about it. It's a little bit of that poli-sci aspect of it. It's like, oh, we're going to have an argument. But I always say this is the opportunity for change. I say, okay, I hear you. Okay, great. What's more expensive? A bag of apples or Cheetos? They say bag of apples, because those Cheetos are, you know what, $2 for, like, I don't know, a giant bag of Cheetos. You know, it's going to cost me like $3-4 for that bag of apples. You can just grab an apple and eat out of there. That's great. That's wonderful. Okay, great. Okay, so what's more expensive? You know, Top Ramen or a whole chicken? And they'll be like, well, whole chicken's obviously more. But, I mean, that's, you know, they should just know, you know. But if you cook it the right way, you can get, like, three meals out of that. Oh, okay, you're assuming. And then I ask people, so do you know how to break down a chicken? Do you buy the whole chicken, like, right from a butcher? Like, oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a grocery store that actually, in your neighborhood, that's easy for you to get to, that has a butcher in it, where you can actually buy a whole chicken for you to break down? They're like, oh, no, my butcher just breaks it down for me, and I just get the good breast meat. Like, oh, that sounds really nice. You know, not everyone has all of those things you just described. And I say, so you have the time to cook. You know, and then, but that kind of conversation is different. And it's a hard conversation, because it starts to talk about the root causes of food insecurity and the root causes of poverty. And that's hard. It gets hard quick. You know, assuming that people know how to cook things. And it's controversial for me to say this, but one of the hardest things that are out there, and I know it's not intended that way, is the SNAP food stamp challenge, where they say, take a week living on a food stamp budget. What could you do? I make the argument that anyone could do anything in a week. Okay. And I've seen people be really successful in that, because they're like, yeah, I'm just going to eat Cheetos and I'm going to eat, you know, ramen for a week. I can do that for 7 days. Okay. I can even feed my kids like that for 7 days. On the eighth day, I know I'm going to change and go back to healthy habits. Okay. If I choose to do healthy habits. Okay. And people are like, no, you're supposed to eat healthy. They're like, no, I have X number of dollars. You know, if I want to win this game, I'm going to stretch that dollar as much as I possibly can, right? I say, that's nice, okay? Why don't you do the SNAP month challenge? do that over time. Do that over weeks of working, weeks of kids in childcare, weeks of kids taking them to sports. That gets hard quick, because then you're like, oh my gosh, like, why are my children so lethargic? Why don't my kids wake up? Why don't they have any energy? Why don't they go out and play? It's like, oh yeah, because they're eating cheeseburgers every night. They're drinking soda all the time, you know? That gets hard quick. But to deal with the root causes of that is not only income, but what to do with that income. Do they know how to do a budget? You know, and then I start the opportunity of change that I kind of joked about earlier, but is to have larger conversations on who taught you life skills. You know, was it, were you lucky enough to have a parent at home that taught you how to cook, that taught you how to break down that chicken? You know, another funny, ironic thing that comes out during Thanksgiving, fun fact, 40% of all charitable cash and food donations for food banks in the state of Arizona, and I think across the entire nation, comes in from November 1 to December 31. Okay? It's the giving season. And it's when food has their moment in the spotlight. Okay? The great irony is, like, well, people like to eat 12 months out of the year, not just two. Sidebar. But the... how this really becomes ironic is one of the more popular, I don't think it's the most, but one of the more popular giving opportunities during Thanksgiving is the turkey drive. So, this is when I ask, like, do you know how to cook a turkey? Do you know how to cook a turkey for two people? If I were to hand you a frozen 12-pound turkey right now, would you know how to thaw it, break it down, break those down into, say, smaller meals that can spread over the course of a week? And when you give that turkey during Thanksgiving, are you expecting them to do that, or are you expecting them to have the same kind of Norman Rockwell kind of experience that you get to have at home? How are you helping them? That's a harder conversation. And that kind of example that's what's difficult when you start shifting into the malnutrition argument. Because it's not just malnutrition of the caloric intake, but it's also malnutrition of the community, of self, that support system that's around that individual. And that's the big challenge. And so data is so very critical, and it's very hard to tell that story. You can connect the dots with people that have these chronic health issues, that happen to be poor and food insecure. But by the time you get to that point, now you're having a different conversation. Now you're playing defense. Now you're working with someone who has diabetes and is poor and has food insecure. That's hard. That's really hard. You're not in prevention anymore. You're in treatment. It's a medical issue now. But to get people to, before that comes, that's what's hard. To say, like, well, what's the data points that tell that story? I can make arguments that it is those poverty statistics. It is, measuring resiliency skills. It is actually taking, food security assessments. And there's a lot of other kind of data points which work really good on an individual level, but get harder on a larger level, because you have to build enough trust to sit down with someone for them to say, yep, I can't feed my kids, I need help.
And how is that done? I mean, because like you said, they have to build that trust. And how do you sit that person down and say,
person at a time? That's hard. And I'm really excited that the Valley Center United Way is doing this work, and we've embraced this concept. And this is new stuff. how do we do it in an appropriate, culturally competent way? We as the nonprofit sector, we as the charitable sector, need to stop doing stuff to communities. We're really good at it. Without understanding our privilege, without understanding our role in this world, to understand the luxury that we have to work on these particular issues, we're not going to be effective. We need a change to, instead of doing something to communities and to individuals, how can we work with them? And that's, it's a subtle shift, but it's a paradigm shift. It is a, it's hard. It's like, wait. And, you know, you're starting to see some things, but gosh, I've had some wonderful conversations with colleagues in the nutrition field and public health field. And it's hard. It's like, you just, cause you just want to get in there and you see all these problems and it's like, look, lady with these kids, stop doing that. You know, do this. You know, you should wag your finger at someone and tisk, 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 and judgment. You know, don't you see what you're doing to your kids? Of course they do. They see it. But they're trying to, they got other problems that are much more pressing. To make a parallel back to the challenges of being a first-year student in college, it is, without that lack of cultural competency and understanding where they are and how each, it's going to be different for everybody. There's going to be some commonalities. But the biggest commonality is just taking the time to get to know that person and get to know that community. And without understanding that, not only it helps you, you're never going to solve the problem. By understanding that community and understanding that individual, it allows you to not only really understand the root causes, they're going to just be slightly different. An amazing strategy we're doing at the Valley City United Way is we have shifted from just a countywide plan to more place-based plans. And a place could be a community, it could be a school, it's a place. And what that allows us to do is change the conversation from, well, everyone in the county is the same, because we're all Arizonans, and everyone that's food insecure is the same there. Great. Nope, that's wrong. there's going to be some commonalities, certainly. And data can show us that. Even in the 82,000 chronic households, yeah, okay, we get that. But how, what made people food insecure and what's going to help them get out of food insecurity to be food secure and what made them poverty and move them in out of poverty, how that impacts people that live in Maryvale is going to be different than Deer Valley. That's going to be different than Guadalupe. That's going to be different in Gilbert. That's going to be different in Scottsdale. That's going to be different in South Phoenix. That's going to be different in Sun City. Because this place that we live in Maricopa County, is its own state. It's huge. And there's a lot of people. Last census information is close to 4.1 million people. It's the same geographic area as like West Virginia or something like that. It's just ridiculous. It's a huge area. It takes 2 hours to drive from one side of the metropolitan area to the other side. You know, in 2 hours I can be in Mexico. Okay. I mean, that's big. And without understanding where those places are, you're not going to ever have the opportunity to have the conversation to build trust. And so it's different. It's going to take longer to do it. But if you can earn that trust with an individual and in that community, you can start dealing with so many other issues that wrap into that. The other challenge and opportunity, and again, why I'm excited what we're doing at the United Way, is that we also have to understand that these are not just one issue that helped them do this, okay, that made them food insecure. It's layered. It's a lot of things, okay? And that's a challenge because it's, I use the example of like when, I'll go back to like the divorce example. Very rarely a relationship falls apart because of one thing. It's usually a number of things over compounded over time. Yeah, maybe it could be one thing, but really if you start peeling away that onion, you know, it wasn't just the affair. It was a lot of other things that kind of led to that. And how did you work with someone? So, you know, as someone who has worked, you know, not worked with my friends, I work with my friends, but it's, that's what you say when you work in human services. Some friends that have gone through this, and it's, those are hard conversations over time to build the trust in order to even identify and articulate what those root causes are. And that's hard for someone that you have a friendship with on a hard personal topic. Well, one of the hardest personal topics out there is food insecurity and poverty. And to in order, when you develop a friendship with someone, you have earned and demonstrated a level of trust where you can do almost anything. The Arizona test is a true friend is someone that's going to help you move in July. Okay. You know, a not so real friend is like, oh, it's December. Yeah, no problem. You know, but a true friend is going to be out there at 7 o'clock in the morning when it's 100 degrees already and move all the stuff in the hottest day of the year. Cause it's always the hottest day of the year when you move. That's what a true friend is going to do there. And they're not going to hesitate. Okay. That is the kind of trust that you, I think you need to aspire to, and everything needs to be coined towards that. It needs to be more personal. That's how you deal with root causes. That is very difficult. Very easy in one-on-ones. And it's, you know, I've heard some people and kind of hearing this, they're like, so what we need to do is build armies of social workers and counselors that just dive into these communities. I'm like, yeah, that's unrealistic.
That's my question. How do you do this in place this?
But you can, and there's already models that are out there that help with this. And so like one of those models is even in the faith community. And the faith community has demonstrated how you can mobilize and impact change within a large group of individuals towards something positive. And it's not the one, sometimes it does seem like it's the one pastor or the one rabbi that is out there working with 500 families. That's not the truth. What that pastor or what that rabbi is doing is they build that cohesive network of trust that extends. Going back into, you're asking me of like the culture of philanthropy. If you can get individuals to not only understand an issue and give them a positive, rewarding opportunity to take action in that particular issue, that generates an excitement that they want to do more of, and they're going to tell more people of. You do, that's how communities are built. Sports teams, fandom. How do people become fans? How do people stay fans? How do people pass on that fandom to their children? It's because they're really excited about it. And then they take them to a shared experience and they have a really good time and it changes their life in that way. And it becomes a part of their life. It's a culture of fandom. A culture of philanthropy is doing that not only with people that want to affect change, but it's also how to work with a community that needs to be changed. It's working with individuals and spreading that kind, demonstrating trust, demonstrating love, because it all comes back down to love. You can't do it with hate. That's gets harder that way. But it is, that is a, you can do that. And there's examples where you've, where like really good positive examples in the faith community have done that. We've also seen where, specifically around the food security issue, if you can get a breakfast in the classroom started at a school, and Arizona is really bad when it comes to food insecurity for children, as I mentioned, the one in for children, really bad when it comes to larger kind of programs that are out there. And while we have very good, because it's federally mandated, free and reduced lunch and meal programs for schools, because they have to do it, the participation rate in those programs is very low, especially around breakfast. And so, and just again, to give you an idea, in a lot of the schools that we're working with, especially in high need areas, I'm talking about, and high need in this area is looking at the percentage of children that qualify for free and reduced lunch in a school. So in high need, 90% above, 70% and above. And there's a lot of schools, that surround the Tempe campus right here. And what they find is that kids don't just jump off the bus and run straight to the cafeteria to eat, to get that food. What happens is that kids are kids, and they run to the playground with their friends. And they won't want to be seen as the poor kid. Even in, I've seen this, and even in schools where 100% of the children are free and reduced, A, they still don't want to be seen as the poor kid. Then they want normalcy. You can even compound that with the pressures that are placed on schools for school performance and test performance, and how that's reduced the amount of play and resource and recess time. Enough time for them to hang out with their friends, the social time. I go back to, why do poor people eat poorly? Because it tastes good. Kids, they're, yeah. Cafeteria on the left, playground with my friends on the right. You know, if I have 30 minutes, I'm going to go play. And they do. They're just being children. And that's great, you know? There's nothing wrong with that. And then they show up and, you know, they have a teacher who was asked, you know, when is lunch 15 times a day? You know, because they haven't eaten anything. And they're gonna just plug it out to lunch. The participation rate is on average between 20 and 40% in those areas. But, so if you let kids be kids, you know the community that you're working with. And you understand them, and you've taken the time to understand them at their base root level. Children are going to be goofy and weird. Okay, great. Good for them, right? There's nothing wrong with that. By switching to a breakfast in the classroom model, now you have 100% of your kids that are getting free and reduced lunch, breakfast. Now they're all eating. And now they can be successful. What we've seen in place is that once you start that kind of program, different conversations happen. Not only do you see kids showing up on time to class because they have another incentive to show up to class, and they can get food they just played, or maybe they're running late, but gosh, you know what? I don't want to miss breakfast there. It also gives you a chance to eat with an adult. And that's a big thing. It's a little thing that we take for granted, but for some of these kids, they actually don't eat with adult. You also get a chance to share a meal with peers. Think about how many joyful occasions that you've had in your life that involved sharing a meal. It's part of who, part of humanity. And to do that with peers, even at work, how often around the lunchroom table have you been able to share some time with your peers? Well, kids need that too. That's their work. They go and do their job, which is at school. It changes that dynamic. It also allows you not only to feed them nutritious food, but then you can actually work with a teacher to say, why is nutritious food important? Yes, some food is fun to eat every once in a while. But what happens when you eat all this bad food over time? Oh, I feel bad. You know, what happens when you eat this? Oh, I feel pretty good. You can have those conversations. You can have that education outcome. You could talk about, you know, negative behaviors in a classroom. You could talk about absenteeism. You can talk about, eventually, grade attainment. Because more butts in seats, repeated, I've heard, helps with school achievement. I'm being sarcastic. But that really adds to that opportunity. And that is a theory in place. That is how you deal with food insecurity in place. It can also allow you that once you actually have removed that food insecurity off of a household, that now a parent doesn't have to worry about breakfast, and now they can shift those resources into dinner. That helps a little bit. I've even seen opportunities in some schools where they actually instituted, not only do they have a breakfast in the classroom and they have the free and reduced lunch, but they started dinner in the classroom or dinner at school, where now families can come to school and have dinner. They'll maybe pay $2 a meal. They're paying the market rate, which is fine. It's great. But now those families can talk to each other. The families can sit down and share a meal together. They can build a support system with the commonality of their children who, and their friends. The kids can go play. The parents can sit and have a meal together. Like that's parent engagement.
Why is sharing that meal so important?
It's community. It's love. That is, to me, food is an act of love. Food is that when I use the term nourishment, it nourishes your soul. I demonstrate love with my wife and people that I care about by cooking them a meal. And there is something that happens when you, it's an animal behavior. When animals are eating, they have to be less stressed. It helps with the digestion. It helps you focus. You're not in that fight or flight kind of situation. It lowers your blood pressure. It allows you to relax. And when you do it in a communal sense, with a family, with your neighbors, within a school, and that's even in the whole concept of place, even in a home or in a shared space, a third space, that allows individuals the time to make those connections, to share stories, to practice listening, to problem solve. That is, you know, there was a time when there was not a word of therapy and counseling. You just had a good family connection and there's people you could talk to about good things and bad things. The dinner table allows you to do that. And the more we can have that repeated, some of the very best memories of my life have been, and even with my mother who's passed, have been her teaching me how to cook and then us eating that food together. That's how I honor her memory, is by demonstrating that with more and more people that I love. And even the opportunity to show people that it's okay to let the barriers break down, to let the stresses of the day break down. Because you know what? At least we can sit down and have a good meal. You know, that's beautiful. And that is where you can demonstrate trust. You can earn trust. You can demonstrate and earn love. And that's where change happens. That's where continuing of good things happen, and it's reinforced. When we're alone, that's hard. That sense of isolation and desperation and pessimism. That is with someone who's alone. And to reconnect people on their terms, in a way that makes sense to them, and building that network, that's where you can actually get things done, or just continue things. If you think about, people ask me, you know, what does a good community look like? What does good old Maslow and his hierarchy of needs, you know, what does self-actualization really look like? And to me, it is you see it at home of a family that is safe enough, secure enough, confident enough, with enough love and trust and listening, and they prepare a meal together. And I've used that example, and people will be like, if I were to ask you, like, how many times did that happen in your life? And people will think back to that time, the last time that their grandmother was in their house, usually over a holiday, or a birthday celebration, or a wedding, or a funeral. Common thread, it's food. And it's a meal. It's not just food. It's not just like, you know, big raw produce that's out there. It is someone took the time to prepare that for you. And they want you to eat it. And then you can reciprocate. You can do the same for them. That's how you can build the trust. It's beyond the concept of breaking bread with someone. It's deeper. And that's where you can store memories. And those memories can then be reinforced as those trusting building blocks that you can then handle bigger things.
Okay. So we're at 1:42. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, this is a continuation of our interview. Let's talk about the goals and the mission of your organization, please.
Absolutely. So at the Valley Sun United Way, our mission is to mobilize a caring community. And we demonstrate that through tackling key initiatives that we feel are vital to a successful, thriving community. So our core initiatives are to ensure children need to succeed, increase financial stability, and then end chronic homelessness and end chronic hunger. Big things. Commonality through some of those is poverty. Sometimes not. So that is definitely something that we are focused in on.
Okay, so let's talk about, we've kind of touched base over a little bit about the main issues or the challenges facing facing Arizonans with food insecurity.
Okay, so the main issues that for those in Arizona that are facing food insecurity really comes down to its most basic level is a lack of income, a lack of sufficient income, specifically, a lack of time in order to either achieve that income or as a as a result of not having enough income, you have to use more time because work more hours. And then kind of a third thing, and this is dependent, and it's a little bit of a problem statement, but it's also an opportunity statement. It is a lack of, or a challenge of community. And I say challenge as opposed to lack, is that in some of the communities that we're working in place, that's actually the thing that they have going for them is community. And that is an incredible asset that you can actually work with. In other communities, other places, there is no community, and that's a huge challenge. And they don't know their neighbors. They don't want to know their neighbors. They are live in complete and total isolation. And so it is, those would be some of the three top issues.
Okay. Can you explain to me your definition of food sustainability?
So for my definition of food sustainability is beyond the, it's beyond kind of a food systems kind of frame. And specifically on, you know, the growth of food and the production of food and the sale of food. That's part of my bias of working in food insecurity, that in most cases, the growth and production of food is a luxury, yet it does influence it, especially in cost. And it's also in kind of going back into the overarching story of people's bad relationship with food in this country. A poor food system or a poor understanding of a food system reinforces the bad relationship with food. So if you don't know where your food comes from, you don't know the kind of cost or time that it took to produce that food, you can just think that I should, it's my right as an American to get strawberries year round. Why not? And they should be cheap, right? And that's a challenge, and that's part of that bad relationship with food. And part of any, even kind of work a more of a local example is, the state of Arizona has an agricultural history, a rich agricultural history. In some cases, especially during the wintertime, we grow more food in the state than we consume. Because when it's cold everywhere else, it's warm enough here. And so we can grow winter lettuce. We can grow winter vegetables. We can grow citrus. There's incredible thing. We produce a lot of cattle for market. There's a lot of these different things. But if you don't know that, and if you don't appreciate that, or just have a basic understanding of what that what it, that is, but also what that means, or if you don't care about it, that changes your whole concept of what a food system and food sustainability actually is. If you expect there to be always cheap beef without any ramifications, and to see how that's connected to Arizona and California's water issue, I mean, that's, you kind of lose something there. Like, again, if you expect there to always be fresh strawberries year-round, or if you expect there to always be plentiful, cheap ground beef, without any of that secondary question, that's the definition of a bad relationship with food. So I think that, so to, in my frame, in the food security lens, is with food sustainability, you have to change that relationship with people's food, and have a sustainable relationship with food. And that involves where it comes from, how it's produced, what does it mean to have seasonal food? But it's also, it's to me, it is part of that change of that relationship with food is how can we demonstrate that locally grown, seasonally produced food is superior than not. And that is such a statement of luxury and privilege. And that's the issue. My challenge is that, unfortunately, and I say this with as much respect and as someone who is within this system, the question of food sustainability is a question at a point of privilege. And that's hard. Again, poor people don't care. Poor people have other things to worry about. If you have a sick kid, the only thing you think about is that sick kid. If you were worried about paying your mortgage or rent, you're not thinking about the sustainability of your food. You just don't care. An example of this is that, again, you work in food and hunger a lot, and I hear amazing stories from individuals with a lot of heart and a lot of passion. They're doing incredible things. And I'll hear, like, what we really need to do to solve this whole food insecurity thing, Jason, farmers markets everywhere. I'm like, that does sound awesome. And I know why you're saying that. Because you're trying to increase local food production in a sustainable, seasonally produced way that could potentially also start a form of business and economic engine for local communities. I totally get that. Got it. But if I had the choice between a $5 pear or to use that $5 at a Walmart, and if I'm poor, I think I'm going to go to Walmart because I could get a lot more stuff. And when I say stuff, I mean food to feed my family, like meals for my family, as opposed to, I'm sure, which is a very delicious $5 pear. And it may be the very best pear I've ever had in my life, okay? But I don't care about that. So that is a big challenge it's part of that cultural competency. We need to understand the position and luxury of even asking these questions and what that actually means to even the systems we're trying to affect change in.
Okay, so let's talk about how do we change the relationship with food insecure
relationship with food?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Building trusting relationships, one person, one community at a time. And working to some of the natural advantages that may already exist. And this is actually exciting because I think this is actually one of the easier things to do. And this is where you can strategically use a lot of the passion between food sustainability and food systems work in a very positive way. Work with communities that have good relationships with food. Okay, part of that good relationship with food is even how a family comes together to prepare that food. So in Arizona, there's a large population of native-born, multi-generational Latino communities. It is beautiful how they build family and community in multi-generational ways. That is a part of having a good relationship with food. I learned in Tucson, and being, again, not a native, but close enough to a native to Arizona, there's something beautiful around making tamales together. That's a good food system. That's a good relationship with food because it doesn't cost a lot, it's delicious, and you do it together as a family. And when you make tamales well, they don't have to be that bad for you. They're certainly better for you than buying them from a store. It's the same kind of concept when in other communities that do, the LDS community has an amazing rich tradition in Arizona. The kind of family parties they do around canning, oh my gosh, that's incredible. Growing food, local food, in their backyard or in a shared community farm, and then canning and saving the extra food. If you break that down, that is not only, you know, education in what's a good food system, what it means to grow your own food, what it means to budget, what resiliency skills are reinforced in there, and family skills. I mean, that's a good definition of, that's a good food system. That is a good relationship with food. So leveraging with those natural advantages and learning from them, and how can we take some of these kinds of traditions that make sense, that are already proven? It's not a proven thing. It's just what we do. It's how we live our life. That's how we've always lived our life. It's not a big deal. It's just, well, this is what we do. We've always done this. I make tamales with Nana. What do you want? You know, and it's, and you see those things, but we have to look beyond the, we have to look more into those communal things, not the individual things. Yes, we could teach everyone how to cook. Why? For whom? For you? You know, I mean, I'm very fortunate. I know how to cook. It's a practice. That will never learn everything. But it's so much more enjoyable when I can cook for somebody. When it's for myself, I like crap. Okay? I just do. And again, this is not, it's not big, this is obvious things. It's the example of like when, you know, you have a married couple and like one of the partners leaves for the weekend, the other person stays at home, eats like crap because they're cooking for themselves. Okay. Or they're not cooking. They're just eating whatever comes in front of them. Right. That's what isolation does to you. Because if it's just for yourself, then it doesn't really matter. And okay, I'll have cheese and nacho chips, you know, my wife, my dear wife, who I love, when I'm working late, she makes herself quesadillas. I don't know why she just makes herself quesadillas. Okay. Because, and I asked her one time, like, why do you make yourself quesadillas? She's like, it's the first food I knew I was able to prepare for myself. I'm like, oh, that's cute. You know, that's great. I understand that, you know, so we kind of root down. But when you cook for someone else, then you can introduce, because now you're like, I want not only this to be delicious for you, but I don't want to make you fat or poison you. Okay. And so I'm going to care about it. Okay. And because it's not only, it's again, when you cook for someone, it's a demonstration of trust and it's a demonstration of love. That is a better relation. That's that better relationship with food.
So tell me your thoughts about, or I guess the organization's thoughts about the growing gardens in the area or growing your own. Is that sustainable? Is that?
It can be, yeah. And so,
does that help solve the problem?
I think it helps on the issue of changing a relationship with food. Which I think is a stepping stone that helps with addressing food insecurity. The challenge is that where are you growing that food and who are you growing the food with and who is it for? If it's just for you, for your family, that's good. That changes your individual and your family's relationship with food, and that's fantastic. And hopefully those skills can be reinforced and developed over time. Excellent. To address the food insecurity component, why don't you grow some of that food for your local food bank? Why don't you show others in your neighborhood how to grow food? My wife, she has to have a little garden at her preschool because I would not let her do anyways. She has 4-year-olds growing radishes and carrots, and they think radishes and carrots are the most delicious, fun things in the world. That is a way of teaching nutrition, teaching a better relationship with food, to where you develop a taste for food, and a practice. It becomes fun and interesting. It's not something that this old knowledge of like, oh, my parents maybe eat all the vegetables. Anything you're made to do, you don't want to do that. because it sucks and it's boring and you don't want it. That's awful. It's seen in a negative. But if you're like, yeah, I grew that broccoli, it's delicious because I made it. I grew that. That's a different conversation. That's part of that different conversation with food. And applying those different, it's not just learning it, but then applying the knowledge with other people. It's not just learning how to cook, it's cooking with people. That's how you shift from, I love people that grow gardens, but add on to that. Grow food for others. It's not just to feed yourself, feed others outside of your network. And leverage the natural opportunity that comes with food. Cook for other parents that are in your kid's school. Instead of having a play date and just sending your child out into the ether to go and play with some other, and just hoping that they come back. Like, why don't you have a play date where you barbecue something, you cook something together as two families? I'm not saying you have to do it every week, but just that, then you get to know the people that your kids are playing with, you know? That changes that kind of conversation. And gosh, wouldn't it be amazing to, if it's something that came out of your own garden, and let that be a conversation starter. I've seen, it's almost like dog walking. It's a really weird thing. It's like dogs can really break down those barriers and start a level of conversation that builds trust. Gardens do the same. I've seen that. It's curious. It's weird that way, but it's a positive weird.
Okay. Continuation of an interview with Mr. Matthews. I'd like to ask you a question. You mentioned your wife is a preschool teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Can she see, I know you mentioned about the snacks and mm-hmm. she sees them saving it. Can she see when children are hungry and how it affects them in the classroom?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And it's not just with her and her experience, but in having conversations with other teachers throughout the valley. The impact of food insecurity and the impact of poverty, but how it kind of effectuates and is demonstrated through food insecurity, can especially be seen in just attentiveness, temperament, just how pleasant of a kid they are and if they're paying attention. And it's not, to me, it's when you say it like that, I automatically think about my own experiences, and I'm like, yeah, when I'm hungry, I'm cranky, and I'm not paying attention. And it's just because your mind's on something else. That, I think, is kind of the immediate kind of food insecure. I think some of the longer term, especially when you're working with some of this chronic food insecure over time, is you'll see how someone who's eating poorly over a long period of time is going to start to show those signs of being lethargic, of decreased energy, of just kind of all over the place. Like, it's not just, it's like, it's a chronic state of lack of attention, but it's also kind of like highs and lows. And it's more than just like, yeah, they had a bunch of sugar right before they walked in and now they're bouncing off the walls. It's more of like their whole body chemistry is off, and that can be demonstrated over time, you know. And even just she has seen where kind of to demonstrate that bad relationship with food with even at a young age. Even how rewards are done, but she's seen, and to me this is a demonstration of our overall bad relationship with food, but how often we use food as a reward. That's part of that reward system. You got a promotion, let's go out to dinner. Birthday dinner. When you're poor, that becomes even more, when your food insecure, that is amplified. I remember my own experience where my mom, when something good happened, we would go to Sizzler, okay? And because it was, you know, steak and shrimp and the all-you-can-eat, you know, salad bar or whatever like that for $7.99. But that was, it was a big deal. We were going to go to Sizzler. I mean, because something big happened, you know, like we got our tax refund. Yeah, Sizzler, right? And so, but what she's seen with a preschool is that if you're trying to demonstrate good forms of reward through praise, and teaching praise and empathy amongst peers that doesn't involve food, it's different. It's a different conversation, that we're still kind of trying to process it because it's strange, you know, and she'll even say like, you know, it's not real unless they get like a treat, you know, like it's not like, you know, and she's kind of been kind of processing like they could, you know, they could do this amazing project or they could just demonstrate an amazing empathy to their, to, you know, their peer. But if they don't have like a good thing to eat that comes with it, then it's not like a real thing. They didn't see the meaning behind it.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think the, why it's important, what is important for the future of food insecurity? What it, and how to solve it, I guess.
Yeah. So the future of food insecurity and how to really address food insecurity, and it won't take, it's not going to happen overnight. It's really reinforcing a lot of things that, that we had discussed earlier. It is the, it's a better understanding of our food system. It is changing that relationship with food. And it's also, it's just changing our relationship with our fellow human beings. It's going to take a shift away from the self to others. And others outside of your own immediateness. I say that a lot. They're like, yeah, I really paid all my attention to my kids. Kids don't count. Of course you're going to pay attention to your kids. I hope you're going to obviously take care of your kids. But it's caring about other people's kids. It's caring about the senior who lives by him or herself on your street. There was a really bad example of this, that is a heartbreaking example. A few months ago, there was a story through social media of an individual who was an older individual. I think it was like 80, between 80 plus. And he ended up calling 911 because he was starving at home. And the 911 operator sent over a police officer with groceries and with some prepared sandwiches and things like that. Now, when I started sending that over, people were like, oh, that's beautiful that they focused on the police officers that responded. And I said, you know, that is nice. Thank goodness we have these public servants who have to care about and have been charged with a duty to care about other people, okay? That's their job. Thank goodness we have them. But imagine if he, that older gentleman, lived in such a caring community that his neighbors knew that he was going to the hospital to have this procedure done. They noticed he wasn't around. They looked for him. They cared enough to ask. They cared enough to say hi. And that, you know, they noticed when he came home and they went and checked in on him. And they said, do you have everything you need? A caring community doesn't need to have to resort to where he has to call he had such little connection with the people that he lived around and lived with in a neighborhood that he had to call the police in order to have people bring him food. So the future, and I think the solution, is how can we build more of that outward focus? How can we ask ourselves, you know, who else can we work with? Who else can we connect with? And seeing how that is not an act of, it's actually, in a strange way, it's actually an act of selflessness, actually selfishness. By turning outward, you can actually, you're going to get a lot more out of it. It's not just the whole, like, you know, giving gifts is better than receiving gifts, but it is, don't you want to live in a community where everyone is happy and healthy? I mean, maybe the opposite is less appealing, but you have an effect to that. You can help your neighbors be successful just by saying hi to them, by taking the time to ask how their kids are doing. By, you know, if you're out in the yard, mowing your yard, and you see that, you know, their neighbor's kids playing, you know, keep an eye after them. You know, you don't have to tell them how to raise their kids, but just, gosh, if you see it, you know, a car that's speeding down the road, I hope you look after that kid, you know. And if they do that for you, that's a good thing too, you know. And if we're all looking outward, then it's, you're going to benefit from it. You know, you're going to have that support system, that resiliency. That's how we really address the food insecurity.
So let's talk a little bit, a quick question about what you, so you mentioned the goals for 2020 mm-hmm. were to eliminate two-thirds of
chronic food insecure.
So what do you think the goals will be for 2040, or the reality by 2040? What are you hoping the reality will be 2040, perhaps food insecurity?
Great question. I think that we will be able to achieve our goals. But there'll be more work to do. And the trick, or kind of the challenge statement, is how do we see the product of success, and what does that look like? And so an opportunity, and I think a little bit of a to stretch ourselves and to push it, is in a way we either need to add to our goals or we need to adjust our goals. And what does success look like? And redefine that. So if it's just about ending chronic hunger for 82,000 households, that sounds wonderful. How? Tell me how and what does that look like? We would already make the argument that we are going to address the root causes of food insecurity. Great. What does that look like? That means happy, healthy communities. That means people that are happy and unicorns and rainbows. Great. What does that look like? And so it's taking that time and challenging ourselves to go one step further. And we at the United Way, and I know I say this a lot, I probably get some rolling of eyes, but I just don't want to end chronic food insecurity with these households. And places in Maryvale and Central City South and Guadalupe and these other communities around Maricopa County. I want to be a part and work with the community to transform it into the very best places to live in the Valley. And not to gentrify it. No. It's to raise that element of community pride where they take care of each other. Our definition of success should be, how can we get the families and the households that we're working with on the businesses that we're working with to become a future donor and volunteer of the United Way. That's different. It's not to like, how do we mobilize all these donors and volunteers to do all this stuff like this? Okay, how do we grow our donor database? To get someone to the point where they're so confident and have enough resources where they can donate that time. They have an abundance of time so they can donate. They have an abundance of resources to donate cash. We have sparked and reinforced that element of philanthropy to where they not only have received it, they've appreciated it, they see the value of it, and now they feel it's their time to repair the world and give back. That is a better measurement. That's not written down anywhere, but that should be kind of that level of goal attainment, individual, household, community.
Okay. Can you tell me what policy changes or other changes at the state level that you think could make an impact to achieve these goals?
Yeah, this is where it gets hard. Changing policies and changing the attitude that victimizes and shames the poor as a philosophy, and the policies that go behind that or come from that is very key at the state level. So what does that look like? That is reducing TANF benefits from 24 months to 12 months. TANF is public assistance. That is not requiring everyone that has a SNAP card, food stamp card, to have their photo ID on it. That is understanding the importance of a livable wage. That is understanding that to really increase economic development in a community, people need a good transportation system, a good reliable transportation system. Those are just some big policy things, but it all starts with a philosophy shift. And the philosophy shift is, to say paradigm shift is really, it's a philosophy, and I think it's almost, it's deliberate. If you believe that the best way to prevent something is to scare the heck out of people, that will have some impact. But it doesn't solve it. Fear, it can only be so much of a deterrent. You can only build, you can always build a bigger wall. You can always arm yourself more. You can always isolate yourself just a little bit more. And that doesn't work. It doesn't solve anything. You're just pushing it to the side. And so if you make it so unappealing to be poor, through guilt and shame and victimization, and to make being poor like the worst thing you could possibly imagine ever doing, because my gosh, you'd be the laughingstock of your community, of your family, and why would you do that to yourself? Oh my gosh. A lot of those policies reinforce that, the existing policies. But that doesn't change anything. And what happens, I think that the challenge is, and this goes back to one of the very first questions, is when you asked, why do I share this story, my story? Because if you think that it can never happen to you, it's easy to point fingers and to make the other and all those different things. And where you see bipartisanship, where you see people coming across the aisle, is when there's things that impact us all, and all of a sudden it is a public good. So you can see everyone has a veteran in the family. They know a veteran. Veteran issues are very popular. They're not nothing's perfect, but there's attention to it. And then there's a level of priority to it, an urgency behind it. Good, and it should be. I get that. Not everyone has a poor person in their family that they know of or they want to talk about. To use a parallel with the gay marriage argument, is that once it was seen, once you created an environment where it was safer and comfortable to come out and talk about the issue of what it is to be gay, lesbian, questioning, transvestite, then you could actually talk about what it means to be a human and live in that world, and the issues of love and equity. And even equity, it was like, it's funny because it started off being like equity and not everyone really understood what equity meant. And so they gave the tangible example of love. And like, oh, love. Okay. Yeah, I love people. You know, I mean, you know, it's okay. I can understand that. And things started to shift. And there's change. I think when it comes to poverty and food insecurity is that people don't think they're ever going to be hungry. They certainly never think they're going to be starving. And so changing the conversation, seeing how it could impact them, seeing how it could impact their community. And I'm sorry, but when you have 1 in 4 children, 1 in 5 adults, and 1 in 7 seniors in Arizona that are facing food insecurity, it's happened to people that they know. They're just not talking about it because they're ashamed of themselves. And they're afraid that, you know, they're afraid that you're going to judge them. So don't talk about it, you know? Yeah.
How do you start those conversations, though?
One-to-one, around a dinner table. You have to practice what you preach. The challenge is that where the root of the answer to your question is, it's very difficult because how we communicate has been different, is changing. And it's so much easier to find an echo chamber, to isolate yourself, and to just find the people that agree with you. Modern technology and just preference has made it so easy to find people that only agree to you. Imagine a social media platform that had an algorithm that instead just gave you more of you wanted to see, flipped it. So everything that you wanted to see, it gave you the opposite. Your whole world would change real quick. Or you just stop using that social media platform because it's yucky. It's not what you wanted. That plays out in the public space very quickly. It plays out in the neighborhoods we decide to live in. It plays out in the conversations we have with our family members, all those different things. So it's going to take some courage on ourselves to actually have those conversations with other people who don't agree with you. That's hard. That's probably the hardest thing. You know, I mean, it's hard enough to make friends. Now you want me to make friends with people that don't agree with me. Oh, my gosh. But you know what? We all eat. I've had incredible conversations with people that I politically vehemently disagree with. But God, we've had great meals. And we've had some, through that meal in the shared space with that shared meal, I've been able to at least understand where they're coming from. I may not agree with it. I will do my best to convince them otherwise. You know, they will do the same with me. But gosh, at least we're having the conversation. finding those times, my bias is with food, because again, we all got to eat. That's the opportunity, but it's the challenge. And if you don't take the time to cook, if you don't take the time to share a meal with your own family, you're definitely not going to do it with somebody you don't agree with. That's what's so unique about, and I think that there's, this is a little bit of my English literature background coming in. The best stories are the ones with conflict. There's some conflict that brings people together over something. Something's happening that wasn't planned and brings people together. That's why you have so many movies that revolve around marriages and deaths and, you know, something like that. It's how can you utilize even existing opportunities? In the Jewish tradition, there is the cedar table and over Passover. And it's encouraged, and it's a mitzvah, to bring in people that aren't Jewish into your house and share a meal with them and to share the Passover story. And through that action in my family, I've had incredible conversations with Christians about religion, which is not another easy topic to do, that people have a lot of passion and beliefs behind. And we've had amazing conversations and disagreements, but we did it over a meal and it was okay. And we spent hours with each other and we're friends. That's good. Now we can continue to have conversation about other things because we at least have done that. That is, I think, is how you start.
So my final question, can you share your fondest food memory?
I have a lot of fond food memories.
A couple.
Yeah. It's funny because my icebreaker for community conversations is actually that exact question, which is funny. So I've had a chance to think about it and to share a number of memories. So I'll share two. One I was already thinking about when I was talking about my mom. My mom was a military brat, but raised in Georgia. And so she loved to cook Southern fried chicken and biscuits, homemade biscuits, scratch drop biscuits specifically. And I have multiple, I'm thinking about three or four dozen or so times in my life. But specifically, I'm thinking about the smells and the sounds and the tastes that from those specific meals of mom getting out the big cast iron frying pan, mom getting the oil out. She's got the chicken. She's got the brown paper bag with the flour and the Lowry's seasoning salt and her shaking the bag. That sound of the first drop of fried, deep fried food. And it's just the explosion of grease and sounds. Sometimes they like, it's splattering up on her. And it's kind of, even though it happened dozens of times, it's always going to be that one little spark that lands in your arm and burns you. The smell of I'm even salivating thinking about it. It is the smell of fried chicken, of the salt and the baked bread in the house. And really that was the meal. It was that. And I remember the plates and we would just talk. And that would be like an afternoon experience. It wouldn't just be like an hour experience. It'd be an afternoon. Incredible memories. And that's how I remember and think of my mom. Second amazing meal was the one with my wife, Emma. And we were in Siena, Italy. And we just got engaged and we had an engagement trip. If you really want to help secure the deal with marriage, do it right before you go to a 2-week trip to Italy. I'm just saying, that's going to increase your odds. We were in a ravine, in the shadow of the city hall in Siena, Italy. And we were in this farm that was actually a rehab place for individuals that were coming out of either prison or some kind of like drug or addiction issues. And what they did was they actually had those are coming out, work the farm, raise the animals, grow the food, and there was a restaurant there, and they produced the food, they packaged the food, they processed the food, they then cooked the food, they then sold the food in this restaurant. And to have, for them, the production, the growth, the cooking, the serving of the food was done with such an aspect of pride and love and trust, because this was not just a meal. This is them demonstrating an aspiration through food. And this is them proving themselves. And that intense form of emotion behind and care behind that meal produced the most amazing product that I can, everything from lima beans that were grown right over there, that were harvested, warmed from the sun, and is literally plucked, washed on the table. And the creaminess of the beans and the goat cheese from those goats right over there that you could hear in the background that were made, and the bread that was baked and the pasta and the tomato sauce from, you know, I think that they didn't grow the wheat. So they that was the one thing that was brought in. But from the tomato vines that were right over there, and to see part of even the presentation is that they would bring forth representatives of people that help prepare your meal, grow your meal, and they would introduce the meal to you and to say, this is what you're eating. And just the seriousness and the pride that they had in talking about this food. You're not having a meal. You are digesting with your soul and your stomach what they want to be, the change that they want to be. That's incredible. I mean, but it was through a meal. We heard their stories through this meal. We saw the change they wanted to be through this meal. That's amazing. And that's the kind of stuff that is when I see the transformative power of food, the transformative power of sharing a dinner, sharing a meal together. That's the kind of opportunity you have.
Last question, just one more.
Sure.
Why do you do what you do?
How?
In the job you do?
Oh, I have to. It goes back to my faith. It goes back to that saying of Tikkun Olam, which is to repair the world. And to repair the world is not from a sense of a top down approach to where you have to, it's like, you know, from a position of privilege. It's just knowing that we're on this world, and there's people in this world, and there's going to be times when this world is not at its good point, and the people are not going to be at a good point. And it's more of stewardship and obligation. You didn't just pop on here out of accident. There was a series of things that happened for you to be here, for you to exist. And it's not just what happened with you, but it's your entire history of what was, what is, and what will be. And if we all just take a little bit of time and to help repair the world in our own way, this will make it better for when we're gone. So that's kind of the overarching philosophy. Two, kind of a second reason is I have to do it because I benefited from it. I want to be the Christine Wald Hopkins who took the time to care for a student. I want to be that social worker that helped, you know, at that office, you know, that one day. I want to be the counselor who took the time to reach out and say, "Are you okay?" It is those, since I benefited from it, I have the obligation, and I have to do it for others. Because if I don't, by failing to do that, I'm not only disrespecting what they did for me, I'm cheapening their service. And it's not, selfishness is not the word for it. It's just disingenuous, and it's fraudulent, and it's a crime, at the most heinous level. And I just can't do that. I can't live with myself that way. And I guess the third thing is just fun. I love this stuff. And it's working with people it's fun. It's such a joy to be able to do this. It's frustrating and it's not easy, but that's the fun part for me. And it's complicated and it's weird, and you know, because people are weird and they're complicated and they're awesome, but that's the joy in it.
What's the most rewarding part of your job?
It's making a difference, but it's helping people.